The next speaker is George Lipsitz.
Lauryn Hill has a song called The Final Hour, which she describes as an opus to reverse the hypnosis, a way to change the focus from the richest to the brokest. I think what we need to do today is reverse a hypnosis which encourages us to see the destruction and the reconstruction of New Orleans from the perspective of the rich. And we got a instructionary lesson on that by President Bush, who 6 days after the hurricane struck, stopped off at Louis Armstrong International Airport to tell America what he did on his summer vacation. In that brief announcement, at a moment when hundreds of thousands of people were homeless and tens of thousands were incarcerated in the Superdome and the convention center, when the streets were flooded with raw sewage, the president gave an example of compassionate conservatism by predicting that the city of New Orleans would actually be improved by the hurricane, saying and remembering fondly that the town he used to come from Houston, Texas, to enjoy myself, and then he winked and smirked occasionally too much, that very same town will be a better place to come to. To the president, and perhaps to much of his core constituency, the meaning of New Orleans rests with Bourbon Street, a tourist attraction characterized by excessive drinking, lurid sex shows, music that simulates the golden age of Dixieland jazz. And as he said, this New Orleans is a place to come to from somewhere else, not a place to live in, a spot for revelry that can be smirked about knowingly by repentant sinners in retrospect after one's return to bourgeois respectability and domesticity. And this was the only New Orleans that the president could imagine worthy of rebuilding. But we've been hearing these last 2 days that there's another New Orleans. This is a city where streets are named Melpomene, Elysian Fields, and Desire. This New Orleans is the home of Mahalia Jackson, Louis Armstrong, and Jelly Roll Morton. It's the place where Homère Plessy and other Creoles of Haitian ancestry had the temerity to challenge segregation by defying the Louisiana Separate Car Act in 1891 and 1892. It's the city that served as the base of operations for the great Tom Dent, whose face we had the pleasure once again of seeing in the video that Brenda Marie Osby showed us, of Lolis Ely and Jerome Smith, and of the great Richard and Aretha Castle Haley, perhaps two of the most visionary and moral forces in the civil rights movement. They used New Orleans as their base in fighting Jim Crow segregation in Louisiana and Mississippi during the 1960s. Louisiana is a place where Irma Thomas and Bessie Griffin are still heard on the radio, even when they don't have current hits or recording contracts. It's a place where musicians cook red beans and rice on the job. And it's the place where Tim's Barbershop on North Claiborne for many years advertised itself as the place where you could get your hair dyed, fried, and laid to the side. New Orleans is home to more than 15,000 Latinos and 10,000 Asians. It's not only one of the southernmost ports of the U.S., but it's the most northern port of the Caribbean, a place that has been in continuous daily contact for centuries with ships, sailors, passengers, and cargo from Cuba, Haiti, Puerto Rico, Trinidad, and Mexico. This New Orleans is an island city. Cyril Neville claims that New Orleans has an island culture, pointing to the dreams, songs, and rhythms of Afro-Caribbean countries as crucial components of local life, because this city shares that region's history, and these are Cyril Neville's words, of the slave trade with Africa, souls being shipped and abandoned, cultures confused and commingled, the sense of oppression, the sense of relaxation, humid heat hanging over your head like a hammer, carnivals and rituals and a beat that goes from morning till night, drums that talk like singers and singers who sing like drums. This city of New Orleans shows traces of the history of Spanish colonial rule and Mexican history unlike any other southern city. It served as the base for political refugees from Mexico, including the Zapotec Indian from Oaxaca, Benito Juarez, who worked as a cigar maker in New Orleans between 1853 and 55, mobilizing political opposition that enabled him to return to Mexico and eventually become that nation's president. New Orleans is the place where the Mexican Army's 8th Cavalry Military Band made a triumphant appearance at the 1884 World's Cotton Exposition and changed black music permanently in the city with their melodies, harmonies, and rhythms. New Orleans is the home of incomparable artists and unparalleled artistry. This is the city where Blind Willie Johnson got himself arrested in front of the Customs House in 1929. The New Orleans police charged him with inciting to riot because he was so convincing in singing the gospel song, "If I Had My Way in This Wicked World, I Would Tear This Building Down." In this New Orleans, the blind blues guitar virtuoso Snooks Eaglin played so well that jealous band members sometimes tried to confound him by detuning his guitar just before he went on stage. Yet without breaking stride, Eaglin always got back in tune within the first four bars of the first song. This is the New Orleans where Professor Jo Dora Middleton of Southern University thought she could impress her student, pianist James Booker, Little Booker, with the difficulty of playing classical music, so she handed him a score of sheet music by J.S. Bach. Booker looked over the score and asked, "You want me to play this front to back or back to front?" In this New Orleans today, the great Irma Thomas, the soul queen of New Orleans, sings in the alto section of the First African Baptist Church Choir every Sunday, but she rarely gets to sing lead because, incredibly enough, several other members of the congregation sing just as well as she does. In this New Orleans, the piano playing of Professor Longhair and James Booker, poetry of Brenda Marie Osby and Sybil Kine, the theatrical innovations of John O'Neill stand as monuments to the beauty, intelligence, and moral power of the Afro-Black New Orleans community. The art of these artists has functioned as an opus to reverse the hypnosis. They challenge the global system that elevates white property over black humanity, and they follow Hill's admonition to change the focus from the richest to the brokest. But the pleasures of New Orleans come from a crucible of pain. Ninth Ward poet and journalist Kalamu Ya Salaam, who we also saw on the video earlier today, reminds us living poor and black in the Big Easy is never as much fun as our music, food, smiles, and laughter make it seem. The great artistry of Charles Neville, of James Booker, of Leadbelly, and many others was honed out at Angola State Prison. Little Booker said that he used to develop his musical skills while he partied on the Ponderosa with Leadbelly. George Landry, who is now deceased but formerly Chief Jolly of the Wild Chapatulas Mardi Gras Indian tribe and the uncle of the Neville brothers, was nearly beaten to death by police officers who accused him falsely of accosting a white woman. To make Landry confess, New Orleans police officers positioned his testicles in a drawer and slammed it shut. But he still refused to comply with their demands. And as a youth, Landry's nephew, Charles Neville, felt that he learned important lessons from Chief Jolly about dignity, pride, and place. Charles himself witnessed a black man bleed to death after being dragged along city streets by a car driven by whites. His brother Cyril got in so many fights growing up in New Orleans that when he went for his Army pre-induction physical, he had a long scar on his neck. His elbow was in a cast, and he needed crutches to walk. One of his fellow draftees assumed wrongly that he was returning from the war and asked him what Vietnam was really like. "I don't know," Cyril replied. "This shit is just from the hood." The perpetual struggle for dignity and self-determination waged over centuries by working-class blacks in New Orleans took a dramatic turn in June 2005. Last night, Brenda Marie Osby reminded us that 82-year-old Allison Tootie Montana stood before the New Orleans City Council to speak up on behalf of some of the brokest residents of the city. He delivered his remarks in the wake of repeated instances of police brutality and vigilante violence against black people in the preceding 6 months. On New Year's Eve, a visiting Georgia Southern College student, LeVon Jones, had a very different experience on Bourbon Street than the ones that George Bush remembers so fondly. He went to the Razoo Club on Bourbon Street, was accused of not complying with the club's dress code, and was beaten to death by four white bouncers who, this day, have not been held accountable for their act. Establishments in the French Quarter are notorious for their policies to exclude blacks, charging black customers higher cover charges and higher prices for drinks, and selectively enforcing these dress codes as a way to discourage black patronage. On March 24th, New Orleans police officers killed Gennard Nordy Thomas, a 25-year-old T-shirt employee and part-time college student in the 1500 block of Piety Street. They stopped Thomas as he was leaving a friend's house, claiming that he looked suspicious. They claimed he pulled a gun on them, but no gun was found in his body, riddled with seven bullets, when he died. But the focal point of Tutti Montana's ire before the city council was an attack by New Orleans police officers on St. Joseph's Day, the saint of the worker, St. Joseph's Day, March 19th, at the corner of LaSalle Street and Washington Avenue. Officers dispersed the peaceful assembly of Mardi Gras Indian tribes, these social clubs of black men who masquerade as Plains Indians and parade through their neighborhoods in flamboyant costumes on Mardi Gras Day and St. Joseph's Day. The officers contended that the tribes were marching without a permit and needed to be dispersed. But Montana and others pointed out that they posed no threat to civic order and they had never needed a permit before, even though their organizations had been parading every St. Joseph's Day for more than a century. Montana spoke from his perspective as a resident of the 7th Ward, and as was mentioned by Brenda Marie Osby last night, the longest continuous free black neighborhood in the United States. And as a black worker whose labor as a lather had helped build houses throughout the city of New Orleans, Montana made his living installing the wooden battens on which plaster hangs. He was a master craftsman who sometimes entertained his fellow workers on the job by blindfolding himself and driving the nails into place perfectly. To add to the spectacle, he kept his supply of nails in his mouth and he'd spit them into his hands in succession as he needed them to the applause of the other workers around him. Montana also served as the unofficial handyman on his block, performing a wide range of construction tasks for his neighbors but never accepting a penny in return for his efforts. He told them that people in the 7th Ward had always helped each other, that years ago they had even come together to build each other's houses, and he was simply returning the favor. Yet for all his contributions as a worker and a neighbor, it was Montana's role as chief of the downtown Yellow Pocahontas tribe and as chief of chiefs of all the Mardi Gras Indians that led to his appearance before the city council last June. Esteban Eugene, who is known as Big Chief Pepe of the Uptown Golden Arrows tribe, had actually signed up to be the first speaker that night, but he graciously stepped aside out of respect for his senior downtown rival. And Montana delineated a long history of police harassment that he witnessed with his own eyes going back five decades. He condemned the St. Joseph's Day action, especially the summons issued to Mardi Gras Indian Bertrand Butler, the arrest of Butler's daughter, and then he told the city council members solemnly, "I want this to stop." Those were his last words. Montana then paused, collapsed, and fell to the floor after telling the city council, "I want this to stop." Police officers called for an ambulance and administered CPR as Montana's son, Darrell, held the chief in his arms. Council President Oliver Thomas adjourned the meeting and asked those present to pray. The Indians in the room began to sing Indian Red, a song that serves as a prayer traditionally voiced to honor the tribal chief. Tutti Montana died that night in Charity Hospital. He died with his warriors by his side, fighting for the right of black people in New Orleans to occupy and traverse public space. His final words, "I want this to stop," speak volumes about the seriousness that lies beneath the surface of the Indians' colorful handmade costumes, festive dances, celebratory songs, and intricate language and lore. In a city where decades of housing discrimination, environmental racism, urban renewal, condemning of housing projects, and police harassment have relegated different races to different spaces, the ferocious theatricality and aggressive festivity of the Mardi Gras Indians holds great significance. The Yellow Pocahontas tribe, like all Mardi Gras Indian groups, comes from a specific neighborhood and speaks for it. The tribes function as mutual aid societies. They help their members with unexpected emergencies and medical bills and funeral expenses. They finance urgent home repairs, make up for lost wages caused by layoffs, illnesses, and injuries. And these forms of self-help are important, especially because of place, because of the price that Black people in New Orleans pay for the racialization of space and the spatialization of race. Mardi Gras Indians arrive in a city where territory is everything. They parade through their neighborhoods. Cyril Neville explains the mythology of the tribes is based on territorial integrity. This is our plot of ground where we rule. He recalls Chief Jolly's sense of self-affirmation is rooted on Valence Street in his uptown 13th Ward neighborhood. To Neville, his uncle's regal demeanor and dignity express pride in his place, telling the world, this is who I am, this is where I'm from. This is why we have to think about the rebuilding of New Orleans on a neighborhood basis. Segregation and discrimination prevent Black people in New Orleans and everywhere in the U.S. from freely acquiring assets that appreciate in value, from moving to desirable neighborhoods with better services and amenities, and from reaping the rewards of home ownership built into the tax code. And like suburban homeowners associations and stakeholders in common interest developments, these phenomena nurture a defensive localism. But people who live in the inner city don't have the private governments, the exclusionary zoning, and the tax-subsidized privatism that condo associations and suburban homeowners associations have. Inner city residents can neither control the uses to which their neighborhoods are put, nor secure increases in the exchange value of their homes. Their only recourse under these circumstances is to increase the use value of their neighborhoods by helping each other, by turning segregation into congregation, in Earl Lewis's phrase, but to fashion ferocious attachments to place as a means of producing mechanisms of solidarity. And in the face of this, the organized abandonment of poor and working class people in New Orleans that left them isolated in high poverty neighborhoods, making them vulnerable to flooding, is little compared to the concentrated campaign now underway to disperse them from New Orleans. These plans portend particularly vicious injuries because Blacks in New Orleans have come to depend so much on neighborhood support networks that provide what Mindy Thompson Fullilove describes as emotional ecosystems grounded in the solidarities of space, place, and race. Displaced residents of the 7th, 9th, and 13th wards stand to lose much more from Hurricane Katrina than the owners of mansions, luxury apartments, office buildings, and hotels, because they're resource poor but network rich. And depriving them of their networks is a grievous injury, reconstituting those networks and the spaces and social relations that nurtured and sustained them should be the first priority of any rebuilding effort. But this is not what's happening from the perspective of the rich. As soon as the hurricane hit, President Bush outlined a program of legalized looting to enable corporations to profit from the misfortunes of poor people in New Orleans. Just as he did with the occupation of Iraq, Bush views the emergency in New Orleans as an excuse for an exercise in social engineering, an opportunity to implement the free market fundamentalism that is not yet politically palatable in the rest of the country. He ordered the suspension of laws that require affirmative action in hiring and contracting, that mandate environmental protection, that prescribe paying the prevailing union scale and minimum wage on federally funded projects. The conditions in the convention center that U.S. Black citizens experienced had already been tried out on Haitian refugees in the Guantanamo camp of being herded behind barbed wire and deprived of food and water. The president offered lavish tax breaks to corporations by making the entire Gulf Coast a taxpayer-subsidized enterprise zone, and he exploited the emergency as an opportunity to advance his scheme to undermine public education by using taxpayer money to support vouchers to send children to private schools. Perhaps most tellingly, Alfonso Jackson, Bush's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and one of those Black conservatives who usually claims that discrimination has ended and the time for colorblind policies has begun, made a color-conscious statement about the rebuilding of New Orleans. New Orleans is not going to be as black as it was for a long time, if ever again, Jackson vowed. I'm telling you, as HUD secretary and having been a developer and a planner, that's how it's going to be. Jackson did not specify exactly which principles of planning and development require the removal of black people from cities when they're the majority of the population. He didn't say that it would be unwise to build new houses in flood-prone areas, but he significantly did not say that new housing throughout the city that was built would be made available to all residents of New Orleans as required by the 1968 Fair Housing Act and the 1867 Civil Rights Laws. He didn't explain why he could give vouchers to students enabling them to leave public schools, but not housing vouchers for people who were homeless. And as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Jackson bears major responsibility for ignoring the 50 to 100 complaints per week about housing discrimination that have been reported to the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Council every week since 1996. Like his predecessors in the Clinton administration, he took no action to address the findings of testing surveys that find that black people seeking apartments in New Orleans encounter discrimination 77% of the time. And attorneys representing the Fair Housing Council in New Orleans have won on their own efforts more than $1 million in actual and punitive damages for victims of housing discrimination in the past decade. But the Bush administration's commitment to crime fighting has never included protecting black and Latino citizens of New Orleans from the illegal impediments to rentals and home ownership that are in their way. Secretary Jackson's vision of a decline in the black population of New Orleans supports a policy that both political parties have been pursuing for the last decade. The number of public housing units in the city dropped by 8,000 units between 1996 and 2002, largely because of Bill Clinton's support of a law that said you could destroy public housing without providing compensatory affordable housing for the people displaced. The convention center, which became so famous as the site where evacuees were kept, was formerly the St. Thomas Housing Project, which housed more than 1,000 black families. When Hurricane Katrina devastated some of the remaining public housing in New Orleans, Republican member of Congress Richard Baker from Baton Rouge announced jubilantly, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did." The observations by Secretary Jackson and Congressman Baker resonate with the sentiments of Jimmy Reese, the wealthy white developer who directs the New Orleans Regional Transportation Authority, even though he lives in Aspen, Colorado. Reese told the Wall Street Journal that one part of the plan for rebuilding New Orleans should entail keeping poor people from returning to their neighborhoods. And at Reese's urging, New Orleans, nominally Democratic and phenotypically black mayor Ray Nagin, hosted a confidential meeting in Dallas less than 2 weeks after the hurricane hit so that wealthy investors, sometimes called the 40 Thieves by leaders of the grassroots community, could plan the city's future. Now, in order to provide cover for their plans, Nagin, a Democrat and African-American, chaired the meeting, but politicians whose main base of support comes from white developers and voters were crucially involved. Nagin himself endorsed the ultra-conservative former Bush appointee Bobby Jindal, the Republican, in the last campaign for Louisiana governor. The governor herself has favored using the Superdome monies and money from the casino to support the New Orleans Saints football team rather than the education needs of citizens in New Orleans. And participants in this meeting included 40 essentially white business leaders, two black business executives, one black state senator, and musician Wynton Marsalis, who spoke to the group by telephone from New York. There was no one present at the Dallas meeting who might change the focus from the richest to the brokest. No representatives of the grassroots groups working for justice. No representatives of the Douglas Community Coalition, a group attempting to turn Frederick Douglass High School into a community learning center. No representatives from the hands-off Iberville C3 Coalition established to fight urban renewal and the destruction of housing for black people in a neighborhood adjacent to the French Quarter. And while listening to Wynton Marsalis speaking on the telephone from New York, they had no interest in hearing from representatives of Community Labor United, from representatives of the Ernie K. Doe Community Center in the Treme neighborhood, from representatives of Bob Moses's Algebra Project or John O'Neill's Junebug Theater. They conducted their deliberations without hearing from any residents of the 9th Ward, from the 13th Ward, from the 7th Ward, from the West Bank neighborhoods in Algiers. Now, the plans for reconstructing New Orleans by its richest residents reveal the terrible dearth of democracy in the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, and the United States. They're part and parcel of a global system that values property more than people, that places the pursuit of profits ahead of the preservation of coastal wetlands and the prevention of global warming, that imposes unlimited austerity on the poor while exacerbating the avarice of the wealthy. For the last 30 years, the state of Louisiana has been courting business by trying to present itself as being business friendly, being a place where environmental regulations are weak, for example, by offering tax breaks for corporations to move to Louisiana. You know, much of the infrastructure of Louisiana, the educational system and the healthcare system, which were far better than neighboring Texas, came because in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, Huey P. Long stuck it to Standard Oil, that he basically had a tax policy that in return for making enormous profits in the state of Louisiana, the oil companies had to pay what he considered a fair share of taxes. And because of that tax policy, it meant that as late as the 40s, segregated as New Orleans was and as economically depressed in some ways as it was better than wealthier states in terms of what it could provide to its citizens. But since the, you know, since almost the mid-century, but especially over the last three decades, the policies essentially of what we might call a free market fundamentalism, the idea if you lower your business taxes, if you subsidize corporations, if you make it hard for labor unions to organize, you don't enforce environmental regulations, the promise was you would bring in money and you, things could be better for the average citizen. But of course, what's happened is that the, as Robin Kelly said last night, the area from Baton Rouge to New Orleans is filled with petrochemical plants, which are among the most grievous polluters in the United States. Many of these communities have, yes, but four times the national cancer rate. The area is called Cancer Alley, and the profits from those firms do not stay in Louisiana. There are no requirements, for example, of the number of jobs at the minimum wage level. Similarly, the port, which is a tremendous economic resource for the whole United States, like everywhere, has lost longshoring jobs because of automation, containerization, and the idea that a tourist-based economy would enable New Orleans to bounce back is what's behind the casinos, the downtown convention center, the development, which was again promised, a corporate-friendly development, which was supposed to trickle down to the poor and working classes in New Orleans. Much of the casino profits are raked off by the state of Louisiana to keep taxes low in the suburbs and in the rural areas, and the type of jobs that the hotel, the restaurant, tourist industry provides, as with everywhere, are not viable jobs. We have now a situation where a great deal of construction needs to be done in New Orleans. Again, going back to the 30s and 40s, a lot of the infrastructure that proved economically beneficial to this country was built through government jobs, subsidized programs to do that building. That's not being planned in New Orleans. What's being planned is that an enormous amount of work can go on in New Orleans, but the money will flow out of it. So the question of the economic liabilities of New Orleans in many ways, like many third world countries that follow the structural adjustment policies that the IMF and the World Bank have wanted, have done everything to make themselves friendly to investment. And the investment has taken place, but the profits have gone elsewhere and the social costs have been left behind in Louisiana. And changing the focus from the richest to the brokest is our task, because it can reveal something different. It can lead us to the determination of working people unwilling to let democracy die. The black working class in New Orleans has long refused to concede that white property should be more important than black humanity. Its long histories of struggle and self-affirmation are especially important today, as the destruction and reconstruction of New Orleans compels us to confront the painful truth about how we have actually been governed in this society and the apocalypse on the installment plan that has been built as a result. Democracy is not dead in New Orleans. The seeds of democratic renewal are planted deeply in its soil, in the freedom dreams of its activists, artists, and intellectuals, in the mutuality, self-help, and solidarity of its working people, in the dynamism of its cultural energy and imagination. Shifting the focus from the richest to the brokest enables us to see possibilities where others see only problems. But it will take more than an opus to reverse this hypnosis. It requires hard work, a sacrifice, and struggle. It compels us to confront the people who actually run this country, forcing us to face up to the selfishness, sadism, greed, contempt, and corruption of what is probably the most disgruntled, embittered, and angry agglomeration of haves in the history of the world. But the first step is to hear the voices of New Orleans, to listen not only for the rhythms and melodies and harmonies that we're used to the words of Cyril Neville, who says the world wants to keep the power where power has always been. And every day the powers that be get more powerful by stomping the powerless. But also to listen to his brother Aaron Neville, who says, in New Orleans, you learn to combine everything. And in between those two quotes is, I think, where we have to be, where we have to be from. But the first step is to hear the words of Chief Tutti Montana and to echo them, to look at what has been happening in our society and to say, I want this to stop. I think all of us come up against both our own shame and our own powerlessness in face of the images that we saw. There's something that threatens our own sense of being feeling compassionate people. And I think we live in a society that wants to create nightmare images, demonized images of the poor and oppressed to legitimate a callousness that'll prevent us from ever feeling, you know, what you've just expressed here. But I think we've all been feeling that there's another view, another tradition, another way available to us. And I think it has two parts. You know, the first is what people do with what they have, no matter how small they've been given. You know, think of Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. She's in a very little space. She's in an attic running away from slavery. But she gets a lot done in that space. She sees a lot from that space. And this is what ghettoization, you know, has done all over the country. It's created a terrible thing. But when I talk about the Indians, you know, I don't see elaborate foolishness. I see somebody who is so convinced that their dignity, their mastery, their discipline, their artistry is worth looking at, that they're going to show you everything in their art that's been denied to them in work and in school and in citizenship. And it's saying, you know, look at what we can do. But the other part of it, which is so important, that is we can't have a kind of localism in which each spot tries to make gains at the expense of other spots. This is the notion of home and community that is being imposed on us by not only the dominant stories, but the tax code and the inequalities in schools and things like that. Clyde Woods has this book called Development Arrested about the plantation aristocracy in rural Mississippi. And he says, because we didn't have democracy in Tunica, Mississippi, we don't have it anywhere. Because the people who run Mississippi get powerful in the Senate and they shape foreign policy and they shape the welfare system. And any you fail to deal with it in any one locality, no matter how far removed it seems to be, you pay the price elsewhere. But the opposite is true. Nobody wins freedom by themselves, but nobody wins freedom just for themselves. When people in Tunica, Mississippi win things, they win it for everybody in the world because they're attacking that system of privilege that depends upon somebody lower down, you know, somewhere else. And this makes literal what Dr. King used to say figuratively. Dr. King used to say, an injustice any place is an injustice every place. And we used to think this was just metaphorical, that if some human was oppressed, it lessened you. And I think that's true. But it was also a tactical understanding that you can't fight some abstraction called racism. You can fight racists in New Orleans. You can fight it as it comes into your own immediate life, and that's your obligation. And if you fight it there and somebody else fights it where they are, then you can win. You can't undo the whole system, but you can fight in the arena that's open to you. And I think we come from intellectually, morally, some of us even through bloodlines, and others, as Robin Kelly says, through bloodshed, we come from traditions that know how to make that fight. We're not so disarmed as Fox News leads us to believe we are.
Just quickly on that. You know, one day people are going to tell the story, not the story of the images that the major news outlets put up on the screen. One day people are going to tell stories of New Orleans that are going to be like stories of Linda Brent. They're going to be like stories of Frederick Douglass. They're going to be like stories of Henry Box Brown. They're going to be stories of people making a way out of no way. Because the fact is that most of the people who went into those spaces got out. Most of the people who went into those spaces found ways to help each other when there was nobody around to help. And, you know, my re-education process here in New York, you know, surrounded by all this crazy, insane mediation, has been to stumble onto those that are able to convey those stories to me and try in my own imperfect ways to get those stories out to other people. You did that just now in terms of the question. We can all do that. And that, you know, that's our charge, I think, particularly as intellectuals, is to find a way to create a record that's big enough to blot out the kind of instantaneous record that was generated in the first days after this came up. And we can do that. We can do that.
Well, let's thank the panelists, all of them, for another wonderful panel.